Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions.
Chapter 15. The night air was thick with insects as Eagle and J.W. pulled in. June bugs bumped and buzzed at the yard light high on the peak of Eagle's pole barn. Several older res cars were already parked at odd angles on the lawn, bearing canoes that glinted in the moonlight like giant pikes. J.W. got out of Eagle's black Bronco. The Indians' voices were muted. The older man whom J.W. had seen helping Eagle several days before was standing next to the large industrial scale by the open-lit barn. He weighed in the glistening black lawn and leaf bags full of wild rice and paid the harvesters from a wad of bills he moved in and out of his pocket.
J.W., Ernie Wilkins, Eagle said, introducing them.
Ernie nodded and reached for the next bag.
And this is Supersize Me,
Eagle said, introducing him to a tall Indian with a ponytail who was carrying bags in to be weighed.
Hey, man,
Supersize Me said cheerfully, nodding in J.W.'s direction.
Over there in the barn we got Dave Caulfield,
Eagle said, gesturing toward a middle-aged Indian who had the clipped mannerisms and buzzed salt-and-pepper haircut of ex-military or law enforcement. He wore cargo pants and a big gold cross on a chain that hung outside his sweat-stained olive T-shirt. He nodded at J.W. as he dumped a weighed-in bag onto a huge tarp that had been duct-taped to the concrete floor inside the pole barn. He took up a plastic snow shovel and spread the rice. Trucks and cars continued to pull in, their headlights shining like miners' lamps as more harvesters came to deliver rice. J.W. headed out to start unloading their bags from the Bronco. The barn lights were yellow to cut down on bugs, and the open door glowed like a fireplace hearth, casting thick streaks out into the night. J.W. carried two heavy bags over to Ernie and the industrial scale.
"Put 'em there," mumbled Ernie.
He nodded to a spot on the concrete as he weighed in other bags. J.W. sensed some kind of resentment, but he just nodded in return, set the bags against the wall, and went back for more. Eagle noted the exchange, and when the Bronco was empty, he clapped J.W. on the shoulder.
"Look," he said, "that was a hell of a thing today. Who would have thought we could smoke them?"
J.W. smiled. "Good polar, I guess."
"Good team."
Eagle glanced at Ernie, weighing in the long line of ricers.
"Why don't you go ahead and call tonight? Come on over in the morning and we'll get parching."
His eyes seemed apologetic.
"Sure,"
said J.W. with a shrug. "See you then." He walked off toward his trailer, but turned back briefly.
"Hey," he said, "it was a good day."
Eagle nodded with a faint smile. He waved and J.W. lifted a hand in return and slid out into the cool evening. The yellow barn light faded as he crossed the soft dirt road. Fingers of fog were beginning to lift off the grasses and curl around the bases of the oaks. J.W. took a hot shower and came out in a towel, his hair wet and cool. From his kitchen window, he watched the Indians continue their quiet work as he waited for the kettle to boil for a cup of tea. He could see Eagle talking with Ernie. A bluish light flickered from Jacob's window up at the house, a TV or a computer. He wondered why the boy wasn't helping. He rolled his sore shoulders. The work was just beginning. Now that the rice season was open, Eagle had explained on the way home, band members would bring rice in from Waterfowl Lake for several more days before expanding the harvest to dozens of other lakes on and off the reservation. This was the world capital of native wild rice, and while Waterfowl was the largest, many of the shallower lakes had large stands as well. The plant only grew in certain conditions, Eagle told him. The lake had to be low in sulfates, which is why the tribes worried about copper mining. They had to be shallow as well, with a rich bottom, and the water had to be cool in the spring in order for the rice to germinate. And for this reason, the band was also very concerned about climate change. It had started to affect yield as the lake temperatures rose. They were working with phenologists at the Department of Natural Resources to seed lakes farther north. The other icon of the north, the moose, had almost disappeared already. The teapot hissed and whistled. J.W. poured his cup and turned off the light, then stood there in the darkness, watching the Indians as they murmured, laughed, and quietly worked into the night. When the tea was gone, he turned away from the window and headed for bed. In the morning, he woke to the smell of wood smoke. He rolled out of bed and groaned. His arms and shoulders ached. He should have taken an ibuprofen. He rubbed his hair and looked out the windows. The Indians were already at it, stoking a fire in front of the pole barn. He changed into jeans and a clean T-shirt and made the bed. After a cup of coffee and a mini box of Frosted Flakes with milk, he put on his work boots and headed out.
"About time," said Eagle as he walked down the barn drive. "You want a coffee?"
"Just had one."
"Then let's get you trained in."
He nodded toward a wheelbarrow standing next to the tarp covered with drying rice.
"See that wheelbarrow? Load it up and bring it on out to the fire."
J.W. stepped onto the tarp and took up the plastic shovel. He loaded the wheelbarrow and pushed it out to the fire, where they dumped it into a rectangular black pan the size of a small John boat. The pan's steel wheels rolled on a pair of trolley rails so it could be moved easily in and out of the fire. The four men stood in the billowing smoke and turned the hissing rice with charred black canoe paddles, keeping it in motion so the kernels wouldn't burn on the bottom. The work was demanding, but the Indians kept a steady, slow pace that never let up. J.W. fell in with them. The sky was clear, the air was cool, and the leaves of the sugar maples around the barn were brilliant red. The smell of wood smoke made J.W. feel like a kid again. It rolled out from under the pan and swirled around and through the rice, infusing it along with his clothes. The blasts of warmth on his face, the intermittent sting in his eyes, the feeling of the charred wooden paddle running through the toasting kernels, the hissing over the snaps of the fire, J.W. was entranced. He watched the rice change from green to brown as the kernels fell from his paddle, as if in a rolling surf.
"You don't get the varied colors and smoky flavor unless you hand parch it," Eagle explained, as they rolled the batch back off the coals. "You see rice in the store that looks varied, light, dark, in between? That's hand parched. It's going to be much more flavorful and smoky. Plus, you can pop hand-parched wild rice. You can't pop that uniform machine-finished stuff."
"Huh," replied J.W., taking it all in.
"It takes about 10 minutes a pan, and we get $15 a pound instead of 10. That's a pretty good ROI.
The four men picked up aluminum snow shovels and scooped the smoking parched rice into a clean metal wheelbarrow. Then they used a straw broom to sweep the last kernels onto a shovel. Ernie led the feeding of a new batch while J.W. followed Eagle as he wheeled the barrelful of toasted rice into the barn.
"Our thrasher's what you might call a good example of Indian engineering," he said. "Supersize Me here made it."
Supersize Me walked up, pulling on leather gloves as he came. The thrasher was made from the front end of a Ford F-150 pickup truck set on wooden timbers outside the pole barn. The wheels were gone, and the headlights were painted like cat's eyes. Everything behind the dashboard and front windshield had been removed except the drive shaft, which ran through a 3-foot hole in the barn wall and into a barrel that lay sideways on a welded metal cradle.
"Once they're parched, we thrash 'em to strip off the mazan," Eagle said as he wheeled the barrel up.
"Mazan?" J.W. asked.
"Hulls. Beats 'em to a powder. Some people use it like flour, and others use it for insulation. You can make pancakes, fry bread, whatever. We mostly sell it for fireworks lining."
Supersize Me unlatched a small door on the top of the barrel. Inside, the truck drive shaft was connected to paddles made of old tire rubber. 2 steel cables ran from the truck dash to a wooden 2x6 nailed to a couple posts near the barrel. One of them controlled the throttle, and the other the clutch. Eagle ran the wheelbarrow up a small wooden ramp and dumped the parched rice into the barrel. Supersize Me clamped the door shut. He turned to J.W.
You got a watch?
J.W. held up his wrist.
Cool. Tell me when we hit 45 seconds.
Supersize Me walked outside and approached what had been the driver's side of the F-150, which had keys hanging from the steering column. It thundered up with a throaty roar. He walked back through the exhaust into the pole barn and adjusted the throttle.
Okay, he said.
J.W. looked at his watch and nodded. Supersize Me revved the engine, then let the clutch out. The drive shaft kicked in and started spinning. The drum rocked and shook in its cradle, emitting a roaring hum. J.W. held up a hand at 45 seconds, and Supersize Me disengaged the clutch and powered down the throttle.
Why exactly 45?
Depends on the rice. Waterfowl lake rice, you go shorter, and some hulls stay on, Eagle said. Longer, and you start to erode the rice.
Eagle pushed the wheelbarrow around to the other side, where there was no ramp. Supersize Me went out and killed the truck engine.
Give me a hand getting the rice into the winnower, instructed Eagle.
J.W. unsnapped the clips on the rough metal door and lifted it off. He pulled a lever welded to the back end of the barrel to rotate it on its pivot and poured out the wild rice along with the chaff, which had been reduced to a flour-like brown powder. When the barrel was empty, Eagle wheeled the load over to the winnower, which sat in the barn's center aisle, back behind the big tarp where the raw rice was laid out to dry. He switched the winnower on, and its conveyor started rattling uphill, while its massive fan blew a ticking wind through the clear plastic exhaust duct. J.W. shoveled the thrashed rice and chaff onto the conveyor. It rode up 7 feet and dumped into a chute at the top. As it fell through the machine, the blower separated the feathery Mazan dust from the heavier rice. It blew through the exhaust duct in a sudden hiss and out the sidewall of the barn, where it was collected for later packaging. Excess flour blew away in the breeze like fine smoke, and clean, multicolored rice began to pour out of the bottom chute into a white bag that hung from a small stand. Eagle went to get another bag, then exchanged it midstream for the full one before tying it off and putting it on the scale as J.W. finished feeding the machine. Its rattling hiss slowly dropped off to a few ticks, then just the hollow sound of the fan. J.W. shut it off and came up as Eagle affixed a label with the date and weight.
"This finished product is 99.9% pure," said Eagle. "An organic foods distributor picks it up every Friday. We run these big bags through the packager and labeler to make 1-pound packages whenever we have the time."
He handed J.W. a clipboard with a spreadsheet showing each bag's weight and number, logged with a date. J.W. was impressed by the efficiency of the operation.
"You keep doing what we've been doing. Keep track of the inflow and outgo and report everything back to me. Any questions?"
"This is just so far from banking," J.W. observed. "Was it your wife's idea or something?" Eagle shook his head.
"She was into banking, too," he said.
He pulled leather gloves on and headed back out to the fire.
"Used to work for your boss in Minneapolis. She knew him from when he ran the bank up here. That's how I know he's a—"
"Did I know her?" J.W. asked. Eagle shook his head.
"I don't think so."
He picked up a paddle and stepped into the smoke. J.W. spent the rest of the week helping Ernie run the rice operation. It was mostly a silent detente. Both days, Eagle was away for hours at a time in the morning and into the early afternoon. When J.W. asked Ernie where Eagle might be, Ernie ignored him. When J.W. asked a third time, he muttered,
"Meetings,"
and kept working. In the late afternoons, Jacob would get home from school and ask J.W. to help him with Pride. One day, Eagle overheard the boy asking and barked back,
"Later. We're busy with the rice. Get your homework done, and then maybe Gitche Mukaman will have time to show you a little more of his Mumigo Manadu ways."
"What does that mean?" J.W. asked Eagle as they turned rice on the tarp.
"What?" Gichi Mukoman. Eagle laughed, but he seemed uncomfortable. Depends on the context, he replied.
J.W. turned over another shovelful and spread it out. Over by the door, Ernie was weighing in another rice delivery.
Okay, he pushed.
Means butcher knife, Ernie said as he plunked a bag down on the scale.
Eagle glanced at Ernie with a flash of irritation, then turned back to J.W. with a sigh of resignation.
Sometimes it means butcher knife. Other times it means white man, he said.
J.W. saw Ernie smiling wryly.
White man is the same word as butcher knife?
I didn't make up the language, said Eagle.
J.W. grunted and threw himself back into turning the rice. At night, he took long hot showers in the trailer's tiny stall, trying to relax his muscles. Some nights he listened to Eagle and Jacob's conversations over the bug, a towel draped around his neck and his hair damp, but they were mostly arguments about homework. Eagle wanted to see it because he suspected Jacob just wasn't doing it. Jacob usually said he didn't have any, or he'd already done it all, or he had forgotten it at school. Then he would go into his room, and Eagle would catch him playing online games with his old crowd in Minneapolis, and the arguments would begin again. Other nights, J.W. was so tired that he forgot to listen in. After a few minutes spent reading the big book in bed, he would turn off the light and lay back, listening to the swaying trees and the drunken howls of coyote packs until the world fell away from him. By Sunday, he was sore up and down his back and arms. Eagle had given him the day off. He lay on his mattress and fantasized about spending the day in bed reading the big book. He had placed it within reach on the bottom shelf of the nightstand. Reading it would be his excuse for not moving. But he had a brunch meeting scheduled with Jorgensen. He sighed and slowly swung his feet out onto the floor, bending his neck and rolling his crackling shoulders. J.W. shaved and slapped on some Old Spice, then shrugged into his suit coat and ducked down to look out the kitchen window at the Indians. 7:30, and they were already at it. For the first time in days, he didn't smell like wood smoke. He gently touched his injured nose with his fingertips. The magenta was fading, but it was still puffy and tender. He went back into the bathroom and replaced the white cross. As he put on his tie in the bedroom, he watched the Indians in the open barn door, running last night's batch through the packager. The act of tightening the tie's knot had a powerful effect, underscoring his sense of impending return to his former world. He just wished he had his own car. He shot his cuffs and turned for the door. Chapter 16. Gethsemane Lutheran Church was within walking distance of J.W. and Carol's house. Built during the mining boom of the 1990s, it had high brick walls broken by vertical slices of colorful stained glass, and a roof like an accordion bellows laid sideways. Pastor Rick was delivering a sermon as J.W. slipped in.
God said man had dominance over all the animals and was the steward of the earth, he said, raising his voice. And it is economic freedom that makes ecological stewardship available to ever greater numbers of people.
J.W. spotted the back of Carol's blonde head and Julie's finer hair next to her near the aisle up front. But as he began to walk down to join them, several people turned to look at him disapprovingly. He slid into the back pew next to a group of Slovenian miners, squat single men with short foreheads, dressed in worn dark suits and smelling of Pinot clubmen, who jockeyed down the bench to make room for him. When the service ended, he was the first out the heavy oak doors and back into the sunshine. He descended the broad staircase and walked a short distance down the sidewalk before taking up a position under one of the hickory trees that ran along the driveway to the lot. After a moment, he saw the flash of satin robes as Pastor Rick stepped just outside the doors to shake hands with the exiting congregation. J.W. stood with his hands in his pockets and toed the sidewalk, playing with a small pebble under the tip of his shoe. He rolled it in and out of a sunny patch, then side to side, and around in circles as the congregants poured down the stairs and turned past him down the walk. J.W. didn't like Pastor Rick. He found him to be overly solicitous toward Carol and at the same time judgmental toward him. "Well, you're not as observant," Carol said once when he brought it up. And as soon as she said it, J.W. knew that this was true. Rick could probably sense that J.W. wasn't under his moral authority, and, if so, he likely resented it. Plus, the guy's credit was less than stellar. Finally, Carol appeared at the head of the stairs, and J.W. lifted himself up into an expectant stance. She was standing in the clutch with the pastor, her pale hair shining in the mid-morning sun. Pastor Rick took her hand in both of his for what seemed like a long time, his satin robes hanging from his wrists. He glanced down at J.W. He said something else to her, and she leaned in, smiling, and nodded thankfully, then pulled away and came down the stairs with Jim Franklin, fixing her hair. Julie followed, texting on her phone. The group stopped near the base of the stairs as other congregants flowed around them. Jim joked with another man, and Julie hung back, typing something with her thumbs. Carol said something to Jim. He nodded, and she started toward J.W. His heart turned over at the implications of these small gestures. "John, Carol, are you seeing him?" She glanced back over her shoulder. "Jim? No! We were just walking out." Her cheeks and neck flushed red. He nodded, his heart sinking. "John, I'm not. Seriously." Her blue-gray eyes were open and guileless, and, he thought, just a touch haughty. "So why aren't you taking my calls?" "I don't know. I've been busy." Her brow drew into furrows before she recovered her composure. She tucked a strand of hair behind her ear. "Have you been leaving messages?"
"Yeah."
"Well, I don't know. I'm sorry." Suspicion and grief mixed in an unsteady state. "I'm not gambling anymore," he said. Jim headed over, smiling cheerfully at J.W.
"Hey, John, how's it going?"
Carol waved him back tensely. People were glancing over as they walked past to their cars. It seemed obvious that their separation was a subject of gossip.
"How long?" Carol asked.
Her voice was quick and desperate.
"A week,"
he shrugged as he said it. He knew it sounded foolish, but it was a change all the same.
"Well, that's good," she said,
as if she were congratulating a small child. He nodded, plunging a hand back into his pocket.
"Not really, but it's a start. Are you okay? Financially?" he said.
She gave a small shrug, then smiled, her eyes wisps.
"I sold my first policy yesterday."
"Congratulations." He smiled back, but it was pained. His gambling losses were the reason she had to get a job. He had always taken care of her. It's what he did. He had always managed their money. And he had been so sure that he would win far more than he would lose that it was hard to accept the current situation. Making it back was no longer a possibility. Now that he was moving past the storm, he could see clearly how foolish it had been all along. He looked down, then out over the grass toward the parked cars. It was the largest blunder of his life.
"Frank put me on leave at the bank," he said.
Her face went pale and flat.
"I told Jim it wasn't true, that you would have said something."
A vein pulsed in her neck.
"That's why I've been calling you."
His voice was thick and throaty, and it nearly broke on him. He swallowed hard and inhaled. His eyes felt thick and cloudy. He shook his head, at a loss for words.
"I'm going to get it straightened out," he said. "But I can't pay the bills for a few weeks."
She took a step back and put a hand up to her forehead the way his mother used to when fighting a migraine.
"A few weeks?"
Her face was white and angry, her mouth a slash.
"Weeks?"
She let out a few short breaths.
This can't be happening.
Carol, it will be okay, I swear. I'm past it.
I can't take this. We have bills.
I know. But you've got to believe me. It's over. Okay? It's over. I'm never going back there. He knew he had no credibility. But what else could he say? The big book made clear that the only way to keep from sliding back was complete and utter honesty, a fearless and searching moral inventory, and then making amends. At the time, reading the book in bed, it had all made sense. He had decided he had to tell her, if only to keep Jorgensen from outflanking him, and he had thought it would be better to get it all over with at once. But now he could see that this was a mistake. We're working it out. Frank's just, well, you know Frank. He'll come around, Carol. It'll be all right. I screwed up, okay? But I'm making it right. I love you. I never meant to hurt you. His chest was tight with emotion. He felt naked and raw and irretrievably broken. Her face was a moon. She shook her head and seemed to find him in her focus.
I don't know.
He nodded and smiled. Well, I do. You're still the most beautiful girl in North Lake. She smiled and shook her head. Her face softened, but her eyes were damp. He could feel the warmth returning, and with it a toehold of hope. You are. You really are. So there's just one last thing I need to tell you. To be totally honest. And Carol, I swear, this is it. You're probably going to think I'm an idiot, but last year, I took out a $100,000 second mortgage on the house. There, he'd done it. He'd told her everything. Almost.
Oh, my God.
Now, don't overreact, please. I promise it'll be okay. I'm working it out with Frank right now. But he might say or do something in the next few days, and I need you to wait until we talk before you agree to anything, okay? Honey, this is it, all of it. I love you, and I'm trying.
Trying? You are trying?
An ocean had opened between them.
You know what I mean.
He could see her reading his lips as if she were looking at him through a distant telescope. Jim appeared behind her, and J.W. held up a hand.
Just a minute, Jim, okay?
It came out sharp. Jim held his hands up like an astronaut cut loose, floating back and away. He shook his head at Carol.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to be completely honest here and to make amends. It's very difficult. I mean, I'm used to being the guy in control, the man you look up to, and right now I have nothing. Carol, are you listening? I still love you, and I will make it all back, okay? Nothing's changed. It's just that now you know.
That's something that Jim here, well, I could tell you stories about him, things from his credit record.
Just stop!
You have been listening to Episode 11 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 12 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.